Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam,
Warsaw,
Bucharest, 2-1.
Coming on today's edition, France is home to Europe's largest Jewish community.
Jewish life is booming in spite of what you can read and see, the rise of anti-Semitism, but there is a normality of Jewish life in Paris, and you can see it, you can feel it.
The Jewish community in Sarajevo maintains their traditions and the language, the Ladino.
It's very similar to the modern Spanish, and here we used to have a Spanish battalion as the peacekeepers. And when they visited and they hear the language, they have been astonished because that's the way how Spanish was spoken 400 years ago.
Welcome to the program. I'm Agnieszka Bielawska. Jewish minorities in Europe is the leading theme of today's edition of Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading international broadcasters. With between 500,000 and 600,000 Jews, France is home to Europe's largest Jewish community. A majority live in Marseille in the southeast of the country, in Strasbourg in the northeast, and in Paris. For Network Europe, Radio France International's Nick Champour went to several Jewish neighborhoods in the French capital and filed this report.
Paris has an important Jewish community, and it shows. In the Belleville neighborhood in the northeast of Paris, near the Place d'Italie in the south, and in the Marais district in the heart of the capital, Serge Zweigenbaum is Secretary General of the European Jewish Congress.
Jewish life is booming in spite of what you can read and see, the rise of anti-Semitism, but there is a normality of Jewish life in Paris, and you can see it, you can feel it. There is a flavor, there is a lot of interesting spots in Paris, being restaurants, being cultural activities. Every day you will find tens of different activities, which gather not only Jews, but non-Jews as well.
There are Jewish bookstores, restaurants, and pastry shops all along the Rue des Rosiers here in Le Marais. And it smells good in the Sacha Finkelstein pastry shop. It was opened by a Polish family three generations ago.
We are known for our cheesecakes with raisins. We also have strudels. And right now we're celebrating Hanukkah, during which we light candles in a menorah. And we have cream fritters. Ponski is the Polish name, or faworki.
Pączki są podle non polone. U faworki.
Historically, Jews emigrated to France at the end of the 19th century. Jews who were running away from the pogroms in Russia, in Poland. This community counted about 350,000 Jews. Unfortunately, this community was severely dismantled during the war. About 75,000 Jews were taken from France to the death camps. After war, immigration from surviving Jews from Eastern Europe combined with immigration from Jews from North Africa brought this community as of today to about 500,000 inhabitants, in 500,000 Jews. Algeria, Tunisia and Morocco as well.
I was born in Tunisia. My name is Ishoa. I arrived in Paris in 1967, here in the Belleville district. We have all kept our Tunisian roots, Jews and non-Jews. We're all brothers here. When someone dies, we're all sad, whether the person was Jewish or not. We're family here.
They have many Arab friends, and you see in Belleville that Jews live side by side with Arabs in Paris, and generally speaking, in very good peace and harmony.
Serge Zweigenbaum from the European Jewish Congress in Paris is right. In fact, music venues often showcase Israeli and Palestinian or Lebanese bands the same night. For instance, last week, a Lebanese band performed just before Isabeau, a Tel Aviv disco rock band. Neil, the drummer, said it was both moving and symbolic.
band that played before us was from Lebanon. They called the new government, and after we took some pictures and hug, and it's a nice concept because like 3 months after the war, we're hugging Lebanese musicians. I think it should be a very nice concept for bringing peace.
Speaking of artists, or two artists, I should say, Italian painter Modigliani was Jewish and he has lived in Paris. You can find his paintings in most Paris contemporary art museums. And if you like the opera, you'll enjoy The Ceiling, a masterpiece by Jewish painter Marc Chagall. Nick Champeau, Paris, RFI.
In Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia and Herzegovina, there is a small but active Jewish community. Both its history, which dates back to the 16th century, and the days of the exodus of the Ladino-speaking Spanish Jews, and its present situation in post-war Bosnia, sets it apart from the Jewish communities of other European capitals. Radio Polonia's Gabriel Stiele went to Sarajevo and investigated.
There is a saying about Bosnia and Herzegovina today. One state, two entities, three constituent peoples, four traditional religions, and thousands of problems. Beside Muslims, Roman Catholic and Serbian Orthodox Christians, Jews are among Sarajevo's native citizens. The first Sephardic Jews arrived in the 16th century, expelled from Spain, and were granted certain rights within the Ottoman Empire. The Jews of Sarajevo lived among other inhabitants as traders and craftsmen. Throughout the centuries, the Sephardic Jews maintained their traditions, as well as their language, Ladino, still understood by older community members today. Jakob Finci, president of the Jewish communities of Bosnia and Herzegovina.
It's very similar to the modern Spanish. And here we used to have a Spanish battalion as a peacekeepers. And when they visited and they hear the language, they have been astonished because that's the way how Spanish was spoken 400 years ago. Or Cervantes, you know, Ladino was a really familiar language from my kitchen, so to say. And I can really use it properly. But don't ask me about human rights, democratization, globalization, and everything else in Ladino.
Once the Jews of Sarajevo constituted one-fifth of the population. Before the Second World War, there were five public synagogues. Today, the community in Sarajevo is counting 700 members, out of a total of around 1,100 in all of the country. Elma Softic-Kaunitz, Secretary General of the community.
Things are okay. We are trying to do our best to organize community life, which means to organize different social activities, but also religious activities. We have La Benevolencia, which is a Jewish cultural, educational and humanitarian organization.
La Benevolencia not only promotes the Sephardic heritage of Sarajevo, it also played an important role during the siege of Sarajevo 1992-95. Evacuation convoys and mail services were negotiated, and food and medical help were distributed throughout the war to those in need, not only community members. Today, a decade after the peace treaty, La Benevolencia visits the elderly, organizes education and microloans to help start small businesses, and gather cross-ethnic women's and children's groups. Making the young take part in community life is also of great importance. Jakob Finci again.
Jewish problem here is that we are aging community. In the last 3 years, it was more than 40 funerals, and only one newborn baby. That's our problem.
Many Jews, as other Bosnians, have left the country since the outbreak of the war, and the remaining Jews in Bosnia and Herzegovina share the same problems as other citizens, most notably the massive unemployment and the unstable political situation, with parties still formed along ethnical lines. Beside the problems, though, Jakob Finzi stresses the good relations to the other religious groups and the fact that there is no problem with anti-Semitism. The Sarajevo synagogue, housing the community center, is greeting its visitors with an open door.
And we think that that's the best way to preserve this normality. Because otherwise, as soon as you put two policemen to surveillance, checkups and so on, everyone will be suspicious. No, we are not afraid. We are living with open doors, with our neighbors, and that's the best way to defend ourselves. That's what we think now. Let's hope that we are not wrong.
Well incorporated but not assimilated, the Jewish community in Sarajevo takes part in the efforts to make their capital and their country develop for those who have stayed and for those who may come back.
Gabriel Stiele there in Sarajevo. The Nazi regime and the atrocities of World War II almost wiped out Jewish life in Germany. But the number of Jews has been steadily increasing since the early 1990s, mainly as a result of many Jews from the former Soviet Union moving to Germany. Comprehensive education for rabbis is once again available in Germany. This year, for the first time since the war, three rabbis were ordained in Dresden. Germany's Jewish communities are awakening to new life. Deutsche Welle's Kirsten Rulf visited one of them as he settled into his new job.
Fifteen men, women and children have assembled in this warmly lit basement room, singing and celebrating. Their song marks the beginning of Sabbath, or Shabbat, in the Jewish community Beth Shalom in Munich. Tom Kuchera, a 36-year-old Czech, is the new rabbi here and is guiding their prayers. It's an historical moment because Kuchera is the first rabbi educated and ordained in Germany since the end of World War II. He says this historical significance is difficult to grasp.
For me, it's much more personal, and I still think of that. What does it mean for me to be a rabbi? So I see this importance not at the historical level, but at the personal level. And that's what is amazing for me, and also a lot of responsibility for what I do and what I will do in the future.
After the service, everybody gathers around a table, chatting and eating the traditional Sabbath dinner. The women have brought nut cake, fresh honeydew melon, and falafel. Since Kuchera became their rabbi, Beth Shalom members say community life has changed.
Ich glaube, dass sich die Jugendarbeit verändert hat, dass Tom Kuchera ein...
I think the youth work has changed. Tom Kuchera has obviously hit a nerve and attracts young people who have not been integrated into our community before. I think they enjoy the lessons with him, and as a result they attend services more often.
Of course, there were discussions. The new rabbi changed the songs we sing. So elderly people missed their favorite songs and couldn't sing along anymore. As a result, they argued with him, and some don't attend the services anymore. Also, the service has become more stringent. It is more demanding, but it's not bad. In fact, I like it a lot this way.
These changes may well be the result of Kuchera's comprehensive education at the Abraham Geiger College in Berlin. Founded in 1999, it's one of only three institutions in Europe which educate rabbis. And it combines academic study with the practical aspects of being a rabbi, like giving psychological support. Rabbi Walter Homolka is the director.
We would like to see that people have already had previous training in another area so as to give them more exposure to the realities of modern life. Of course, pastoral skills are necessary. The ability to modesty, to step back and moderate processes rather than lead. Also, leadership skills are also important. So there's a whole range of abilities.
Given Germany's anti-Semitic past, choosing Berlin for a rabbinical college was highly controversial. Though it has its advantages, for example, university education is basically free in Germany. But many Jews were opposed to the idea of a rabbinical college being located here. Homolka says a Dutch rabbi even accused the initiators of disgracing Jewish culture by establishing such an institution on the ashes of 6 million murdered Jews.
The only response possible was that really this is a new Germany. It is a tremendous success to be able to have a Jewish environment again where rabbis, indigenous rabbis, can be trained. We produce, I would say, some of the best ambassadors for a modern Germany because all our students go back and they will talk about their experience in modern Germany, and I think this is a great advantage for Germany and its image abroad within the world.
Rabbi Kuchera also felt uneasy at first about going to Berlin. He says he had to get used to living in Germany as a Jew.
But basically, past is one thing, and we have to remember of the past, but I more believe in the future. We have to be thinking more of the future.
But neither the Abraham Geiger College nor the Beth Shalom community have their addresses published on public registers. They are afraid of anti-Semitic violence. Some community members say they've been attacked with glass bottles by neo-Nazis in Munich's city center. And during Shabbat services, a police car with two officers patrols in front of the Beth Shalom community house. Beth Shalom means house of peace. For the new rabbi, songs and music play an important role in community life, especially because he wants to attract more young people. He hopes that some of them will one day step into his shoes and become rabbis too. The founding of the Abraham Geiger College and Kuchera's ordination represent a great step forward for Germany's Jews. And a fresh generation of rabbis might well mark the beginning of a new period of Jewish life in Germany.
The Jewish community in Sweden dates back to several hundred years ago, and the Jewish migration has had several huge waves. Gabby Katz from Radio Sweden has visited the Jewish Museum in Stockholm and a special exhibition portraying Jews. She investigated the plays of the Jewish minority in Sweden.
The visitor come in and they meet two huge color pictures of traditional Jews. What made it traditional Jews? The attributes. If you don't see the attributes, you don't see the Jew. And all other pictures are in black and white, and they are huge. This is only part of a face. And if you see only this part of the face, you see the similarity between all people.
I'm at the Jewish Museum in Stockholm in front of the photographs which portray Judaism in a Swedish context. But, Carl Gabor, why collect these photos under the title Jews in a Corner? What corner is that?
Now we are talking about the geography. In this room in the museum, I get a corner for the exhibition. But if you think as a metaphor, then I thought some people are Jewish in their soul, some other only in a corner of their soul.
Historians agree that the year 1645 saw the first undisputably Jewish visitor to Sweden. Times have changed, and events in history brought Jewish people to Sweden, notably in 1942 and 1956, a long time ago now. But do you think Jewish families here still consider themselves to be immigrants of a sort?
Yeah, I would mention even 1968, there is a new generation of Polish Jewish. They still remember when they moved to Sweden. But I know where immigrants begin to be citizens. I know if there are some family, they came 200-300 years ago. Are they still immigrants? You can ask the same question to people who come from Bosnia or France or Iraq. How long they are immigrants?
We're going to take a closer look at some of your photographs now, but first, you set about to portray Jews in Sweden. What did you feel that you wanted to capture?
I thought about people who made some kind of impression in the Swedish society. they did this impression not as Jewish, but as people. For example, this is Georg Riedel. He made the most of the most Swedish Ida Sommarvisa. Summer songs of Astrid Lindgren's movies. This is very Swedish. There is Moni Nilsson Brännström. She's the author to Tzatziki books, you know? They're very Swedish.
Children's books.
Yes, yes. I have difficult to describe what Jewish means. I didn't know about it until I was 9 years old. It was not important, but my neighbors, they said, "You are Jewish." I asked, "How could you know it?" when I didn't know about it. As an answer to your question is, that is not my problem. This is my neighbor's problem to define if I am a Hungarian immigrant or if I am Jewish. The neighbors position me to be Jewish. Otherwise, I don't know. You can either be an ethnical Jewish, it means my mother was Jewish, I am also Jewish, or I am a religious Jewish, or I am a member of the Israeli state, a citizen.
Let's leave the Jews in yes. a corner now and move to those two color pictures that greet visitors to the museum and the exhibition. And this very first one, I would say, was taken in a synagogue.
Yeah, and they have all these attributes. There is no doubt about that they are Jewish, isn't it?
They have the yarmulkes on, the prayer shawl, and I would say that this is the only photo in the exhibition where you can definitely tell that these people are Jewish. Was that what you wanted to put across as well?
Yeah, this is the point. You can see he's Jew. But the next one, it's a black and white, without all these attributes, how can you say it? This is the next question. Are the attributes itself so important for people to show I am Muslim, I am Jewish, or I am Buddhist, Hindu, or what?
2006. What does it mean to be Jewish in Sweden today?
Not so much. It means when you or my neighbor or somebody else on the street say, "You Jewish," this means something to me.
And turning from photographer Carl Gabor to curator Miriam Andersson Blecker, the Jewish Museum in Stockholm is very much a living museum, and that I know you often have lectures and events here, but what would you say it means to be Jewish in Sweden today?
It's very personal, I would say. I think you will get a different answer if you ask, you know, any Swedish Jewish person. For me, being Jewish in Sweden today is not different from what it's been, you know, always for me. I have a Swedish identity and a Jewish identity, and for me it's two worlds that collaborate and clash together all the time. And working at the Jewish Museum in Stockholm, in Sweden, has a lot to do with, you know, the Swedish Jewish history. And since it's a long history, it feels very natural to be a part of it. So it's I don't think it differs so much from other minority groups that have existed in Sweden for many years and that have a strong Swedish identity, but also the minority status.
Sweden is often labeled anti-Semitic by Israel. From the perspective of a Jewish person living and working here, would you say Sweden is anti-Semitic?
I would say it's not anti-Semitic. I mean, it also has a lot to do with personal experience. And of course, I know a lot of Jews in Sweden that have been targeted by anti-Semitic accusations and things like that. But for me personally, I have not experienced it in that sense. I would say there absolutely exists anti-Semitism in Sweden, and it's a problem, but it makes you even feel more wanting to work with Jewish culture even more, because I think through the culture, that's where you can meet a lot of prejudice and you can, you know, break down people's thoughts of a certain group.
Thanks for that, curator Miriam Andersson Blecker from the Jewish Museum in Stockholm.
That was Gabi Katz from Radio Sweden reporting from Stockholm. Romania belatedly acknowledged its role in the Holocaust. It was only in 2004 that a committee for the investigation of the Holocaust crimes published an official report, according to which between 280,000 and 380,000 Jews were exterminated by the Romanian army in the war zones of Bessarabia, Bukovina and Transnistria. The last 3 years have seen a lot of campaigning aimed at making Romanians aware of those crimes. Radio Romania International's Julian Murezan reports from Bucharest.
A recent survey conducted by the Research Center on Interethnic Relations at Babeș-Bolyai University of Cluj in central Romania shows these awareness campaigns have yielded results, but at the same time they've had an adverse effect, reflected in the fact that in the last 3 years the number of Romanians who believe that the persecutions of the Jews are exaggerated has grown from 27% to 31.5%. István Horváth, the coordinator of the survey entitled The Interethnic Climate in Romania in the Run-up to European Integration, explains.
What is interesting that this campaign on raising awareness has a double effect. On one hand, increases the awareness of the population on issues of Holocaust, on issues of Romania's contribution to Holocaust, but on the other hand, increased a bit the segment of population which became more sensitive to negationist affirmation, so those beliefs that actually Holocaust was not true or it's oversizingly presented.
According to the same survey, almost one-third of Romanians also think that the suffering of the Jewish people is actually a punishment from God. Andrei Oșteanu is a Romanian historian of religions and cultural anthropologist who's written a book entitled Imaginary Jew versus Real Jew in Romanian and Other Central East European Cultures.
Acuzația de deicid.
The accusation of deicide, that is, of having murdered Jesus Christ, is frequent at folkloric level, at the level of the rural population in Romania, unlike Poland, for example, where this accusation is present at all levels of the society.
At present, the Jewish community in Romania numbers around 7,000, which is almost non-existent. Andrei Oșteanu says one of the most frequent questions he's asked, especially when traveling abroad, is, how is it possible for a country with no Jewish population left to still harbour anti-Semitic feelings?
This question is wrong. It somehow implies that anti-Semitism in a country with a more numerous Jewish community is reasonable and needs no explanation. Well, anti-Semitism is unreasonable anywhere. But actually, in a country like Romania, with almost no Jewish community left, anti-Semitism is more easily manipulated. You cannot claim that Jews have a devil's horns and tail, I'm exaggerating, but not too much. You cannot claim that when Jewish people are present and everybody can see that they don't have a devil's horn and tail. The presence of Jewish people in a country actually proves false all the misconceptions, prejudice and stereotypes about Jews.
It seems that it's not just in Romania that some people believe the Jews are responsible for all the evil in the world. Despite denial of Holocaust being a crime in several European countries, Romania included, and despite the pressure of political correctness ideologies across the ocean, there are slips. For instance, several months ago, famous Hollywood actor and director Mel Gibson drunkenly stated that the Jews are responsible for all the wars in the world. One of Romania's most respected journalists, Traian Ungureanu, however, thinks the danger lies somewhere else.
We should rather look to the government-sponsored conference of Holocaust deniers organized in Iran these days, where indeed what you see is a monster itself. I mean, it's prejudice, it's popular rage, the blatant lack of education, stately sponsored and politically directed. This is a monster, not, let's say, David Irving, who is serving his jail time in Austria. He is a Holocaust denier. Not Mel Gibson, who gets drunk in Los Angeles and has a rant in front of a police officer. The real danger is the Arab-inspired, the left-inspired anti-Semitism, as you can see it in Iran, for instance, or in the fashionable left-wing champagne socialism left circles of Europe, where, sadly, anti-Semitism leaves a bizarre resurgence nowadays.
Perhaps a good safety valve in this rather tense ethnic climate is Sacha Baron Cohen's film Borat. Some may find funny even the scene in which Borat asks a gun shop owner what would be the best gun to kill a Jew, and receives a non-hesitant answer, "I'd recommend a 9mm or a Glock automatic." Anyway, it seems Cohen is one Jew that will not be executed. His film is a success.
Radio Romania International's Julian Murison reporting from Bucharest. Bertie is a Jewish Holocaust survivor. In 1943, in Nazi-occupied Holland, Bertie was rounded up with her parents by the Nazis and sent to Camp Westerbork in the Netherlands, and then on to Bergen-Belsen, the notorious concentration camp in Germany, where she spent the rest of the war. When she was freed by the Soviet Army in 1945, she was 7 years old. Last month, she and 69 other Dutch survivors returned to the site of the camp to finally inaugurate a Dutch memorial. Radio Netherlands' Jonathan Gruber went with her.
When we arrived 5 hours later at the hotel in the rustic town of Celle, just north of Hanover, it was a cool and sunny day, and other survivors were arriving by the busload. Grey, tired, and smartly dressed, some were seeing each other for the first time in 6 decades. A small woman who looked about 60 years old stood outside the hotel, chain smoking. She told me her name was Tamara de Vries, and I asked her if she'd ever been back to Bergen-Belsen before.
No, I've never been back. I never wanted to. There was nothing to see. I saw the pictures. The English burned down the camp, obviously, because there was a lot of infectious diseases. And after that, it was just a spot. But this opportunity to inaugurate a plaquette for the Dutch who died there, among them my grandparents, that I wanted to take.
How old were you when you were in the camp? Because you look rather sprightly.
Well, I'm old enough to have been there.
Yes.
I was a small baby when they took us, and I was about 3 years when it was all finished.
Do you have any memories of it at all?
I have some memories, yes. Especially the fear. Fear of being discovered. Small children were not supposed to be in the barracks. And especially not make noise. That's what we learned, my brother and I. To be always quiet.
I'm just wondering what your expectation of the day tomorrow is.
Well, I think it will just be in a ceremony with decorum. And the Jewish way to memorize your dead. And that's appropriate. And it never happened before.
As luck would have it, Puk Houtsing, manager of War Victims and Remembrance of World War II from the Ministry of Health and Welfare, was standing right there to answer the question. So why did it take 61 years for the nearly 3,000 Dutch victims of Bergen-Belsen to get official recognition from the Dutch government, while every other government with victims did it years ago?
What you see is that in Auschwitz there's a memorial much earlier, that's in the years 80. But what you see in Bergen-Belsen, there was never an organization of survivors. What you do have in Auschwitz, people were organized. That wasn't the case in Bergen-Belsen.
And how did this attention come to you?
From survivors who came to me, that was last year, because last year we renewed the Dutch pavilion in Auschwitz. Then a lot of people came to me and said, well, do you know the situation in Bergen-Belsen? I said, no, I don't know it, but tell me. They explained, and that's when we made the decision, well, we have to do something now.
The next autumn day was calm and crisp. Bertha and I drove through the idyllic and lushly green German countryside to the Bergen-Belsen Memorial. The survivors and their families, dressed in black, walked slowly and silently to the clearing where the camp once stood. The hygienic situation at Bergen-Belsen was so bad that at the end of the war, the British Army simply burnt it down.
How are you?
Heavy. It's filled with sadness. You see that hill there?
Yeah.
It's a mass grave, like that one. My father had to dig one of them, and he was so weak that they shot him, so he was right where they needed him, in the grave.
I think this is the place for you to put your flower down.
Yes.
See? Over there, with the flowers.
And over there.
Yeah.
Along this path here, there were piles and piles of corpses lying down. It is incomprehensible that happened, but
lies like a stone on my chest. This is really what grieving is about.
The ceremony began. Dutch and German ministers made speeches about how it was finally time to remember that of the 70,000 prisoners who died there, 3,000 were Dutch. Finally, the plaque was revealed and covered in flowers. Bertha held her sister Femke's hand as they staggered past it.
You can't even put those feelings into words. It's just like a stone in your chest. It is incredibly heavy.
You've gone up to the stone now and you've seen it now. What does it mean to you?
That stone means nothing. Those mass graves where my parents are lying, that is something that means something to me. That is the essence of what happened here. In spite of the horrible memories and the sorrow, the unspeakable sorrow that hits you again after all those years, I'm glad I came back here, if only to say goodbye to my parents and my relatives, who are all buried in all these 11 mass graves. I hope they have peace. I hope they are resting in peace. That's what I really and truly hope.
Radio Netherlands, Jonathan Gruber reporting. If you'd like to listen to our program again, you can log in into our new website, www.networkeurope.org. This program is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania, International Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Ukraine and Radio Slovenia. Network Europe will be back next week, and I leave you with some traditional Jewish music from last year's Jewish Culture Festival held in the southern Polish city of Kraków. On behalf of the team, I'm Agnieszka Bielawska. Thanks for joining me. Atoch ein Engel, ja, da, me, da, su, me, la, me, le, ja, da, spiel, da, atoch.